It's a pleasure to be here and welcome you all as the first speaker. So, I apologize for not giving a blackboard talk, but I just can't write as fast on the blackboard. So I'll cover a bunch of things in a kind of survey or review fashion, and I won't be able to go through the details, but hopefully during the several days of workshop, we can do that. So this is based on several papers. There is a recent review which contains a lot of this work, which was put on the web and is now published just this few months ago. Okay, so I should thank all my collaborators who are mentioned here. So there's basically several different things which I'd like to talk about. I'm sure I won't get to them all, so I'll try just to give an overview and try to hit the important points without going into most of the details. So I think I don't have to say too much about quantum effects in de Sitter space. A lot of the people here have worked on it and are somewhat expert in it. I will want to talk about the role of anomalies in effective field theory, because main point I'm trying to get across today is that conformal anomaly in particular, but anomalies in general, are actually important and need to be taken into account, even at the low energy scales of that we're interested in, very far from the Planck scale, for example, in gravity. So I'll go over a couple of examples. Again, it'll have to be brief. The axial anomaly in QCD, for those who know about that, and the 2D gravity case, which Polyakov, for example, discussed. And I'll show you what we've done a little bit in four-dimensional anomalous amplitudes. So the point, and if you take away nothing else, the main point of the talk is here written in red, is that the effective theory of low-energy gravity coming from inclusion of the anomaly, in addition to the ordinary classical Einstein-Hilbert terms, actually contains new scalar degrees of freedom. And these are potentially quite important in several different cases, such as in black holes, which I won't talk about, and horizons in cosmology, which I will talk about. And they can also lead to new fluctuations on cosmological scales, and even the running and relaxing of the effective cosmological term to zero. So some of the details are discussed in recent papers on the linear response in de Sitter space, where we can really flesh out these cosmological horizon modes from the anomaly, and some of the potential predictions or applications of the ideas are to the microwave background, and in particular non-Gaussianity. So I'm sure I won't get to all these things, but let me at least try to dive in. So again, I don't have to remind people in this audience that we apparently live in a universe which is dominated by dark energy, perhaps 70-72% of it, if you believe the supernova data at face value. And because of that, the expansion is actually accelerating, because this quantity is negative rather than positive. And we are presented with the smallest dimensionless number to ever be measured in nature, which is the cosmological constant, if you wish, the vacuum energy in units of h bar g and c cubed, which is a number times 10 to the minus 122. And so if we had any needed any motivation for studying de Sitter space, it could be that we actually live in a universe that's very close to de Sitter space, that's dominated by dark energy. And of course, the problem of explaining the size of this number is one of the outstanding hierarchy problem, I would say, by far a bigger hierarchy problem than that of the electroweak scale. So these are the motivations, if you need any, both from the observational and theoretical side. Now, if we start to think about this, there's a wide range of opinions and statements in the literature, so I'd like to just put out my own point of view here right at the beginning. So, you know, basically, this whole hierarchy issue is a tension between microscopic physics. You know, we talk about renormalization, we talk about ultraviolet effects, and at the same time trying to put them in a cosmological context, which is the very largest scales in nature. So how should we think about this, microscopic or macroscopic? So basically, I'm going to take the point of view that something which is on the scale of the horizon should be understandable within an effective field theory language. We should not have to know what the theory of gravity is at the Planck scale and what its ultimate resolution of the difficult issues of quantum gravity are in order to make sense and have some control of gravity at distances like the cosmological scale. So that argues, if you take that point of view, or at least let's think of it this way, let's take this point of view and push it as hard as we can until we run into an obstacle. And if we then can't go any further, of course, then one has to rethink. But I do believe that the effective field theory approach is the right way to think about this. And that's basically bundling up microscopic physics into a few low energy parameters and effective fields, if you wish. So in that way of thinking, lambda, the constant of Einstein's theory, is a free parameter of the low energy effective theory, which can, if you have quantum effects, eventually field renormalization effects and can run in principle with the scale and be state dependent. We know that even in the standard model, you have spontaneous symmetry breaking, so that the effective value of lambda picks up contributions from, for example, the Higgs or the other scale of field potentials. So therefore, it's not surprising at all that the effective value of lambda, which, for example, couples to gravity and drives inflation, is state-dependent, depends on the dynamics of fields, and the state is described by some effective fields, not necessarily at the Planck scale, but at very large scales. And, of course, this is based on the idea of decoupling, that high energy and infrared physics generally decouple. It's a theme that runs through basically all of physics. If we didn't have decoupling, we couldn't say much about anything. We would have to know the quantum theory of gravity before we could discuss the orbit of Jupiter. So it doesn't work that way. We usually are able to discuss infrared and ultraviolet physics. And so the basic point I'm trying to make in this talk is that the Casimir effect is an example of vacuum energy in which the issue of fixing the boundary conditions arises. So it's a quantum effect, but it's a quantum effect at very large scales, macroscopic scales. Okay. So, of course, there's this wonderful quote of Pauli, that just because something is infinite does not necessarily mean that it is zero. Okay. So, again, I'm going to go quickly over basic things. It's the first talk, so I guess I felt the obligation to put up a couple of slides about the Sitter space, but I think probably everyone knows it's the maximally symmetric solution to Einstein's equations for the positive cosmological term. It can be represented as a hyperboloid of revolution in one higher dimension. So if you take a five-dimensional metric and impose the constraint that the five variables with the negative Minkowski signature for time is equal to a constant, that defines a hyperboloid. And you can represent coordinates on the hyperboloid in various ways. For example, with flat sections, that's ones that one is most commonly using in cosmology. And there you have an exponentially expanding scale factor. On the other hand, you can represent things in other ways with three sphere sections, or even in static coordinates, in which there's no time development at all. The translation with this time, t, is distinguished from that time, tau. I use tau for the Robertson-Walker or co-moving time, and t for the static time of De Sitter coordinates, and of De Sitter static coordinates. So in this frame, t, translation by t is a killing field and a symmetry, therefore, which is a statement that's independent of the coordinate representation. Okay, so here's the mandatory hyperboloid picture. The cuts on the horizontal sections are three spheres, and the Robertson-Walker time generally runs upward, but the static time is sliced in a different way. You can also represent things on the conformal diagram of Carter and Penrose, and then the entire hyperboloid is mapped to the square. This is the infinite past. The infinite future is up there, and this makes apparent the causal structure of the sitter space, the fact that this time-like Killing field, which are the orbits of those hyperbolic-looking curves, actually changes sign and becomes singular at the horizon here, which is at the De Sitter radius of 1 over h, where h is the Hubble constant related to the cosmological term. So this, the static coordinates are covering only one quarter of the manifold as represented here. There's another copy of them on the other side in which the time is running in the opposite direction. So this, at a glance, gives you the conformal and causal properties. Of course, in the Carter-Penrose diagram, light cones are at 45 degrees by construction. Okay. So over the years, a number of people, myself included, and some others who are here in this audience, have studied quantum effects. So the classical De Sitter manifold is what it is. It has that maximal analytic extension, can represent in different coordinates. But from the early days, I would say, there's been suspicion and a growing body of evidence that trying to build quantum field theory on this manifold is highly non-trivial, and certainly compared to flat space construction. You see that you have no asymptotically flat region. By definition, the curvature is constant everywhere in global De Sitter space. And so the ideas that you're very familiar with in quantum field theory and building Fourier modes, wave packets, all those things have to be reexamined and thought about in a different and much more subtle way. So the first thing, well, there are various things one could say. I mean, back in 85, I was struck by the correspondence between accelerated observers in De Sitter space and accelerated observers in a constant electric field if they're carrying a charge. And so it very much suggests that there's a particle creation mechanism analogous to the Schwinger effect, the shorting of the vacuum, that if you have a constant uniform electric field, of course, that's a highly idealized situation. You don't realize completely constant electric fields in nature. Sometimes I joke about that and say there's also a cosmological electric field problem, because it's a perfectly good solution to Maxwell's equations in vacuo, yet you don't see any big fields pointing to the Andromeda Nebula. So there's basically, we would say, a quantum reason for that, that if you have such fields extending over large distances, it will tend to short itself out. And Schwinger showed us how to do that calculation back in the 50s. So the decay rate of the vacuum is proportional to the electric field squared and has this exponential factor if it's a spontaneous decay of the vacuum, which is highly suppressed by the mass of the field that's undergoing the pair creation. So there's a similar expression that one can write in De Sitter space, at least for massive fields. And it's very suggestive, right? Because just as the shorting of the vacuum creates a current, and the current, you would say, at least at first glance, tends to decrease the electric field due to basically Lenz's law. So likewise, if you use the Einstein equations and you create any particles with a non-zero rho plus p, that tends to decrease the Hubble parameter. Of course, both of these equations have a solution with zero source, the constant field, and rho equals minus p, that's the De Sitter space. But if you're disturbing that background by quantum effects, such as pair creation effects, they would, you would imagine, tend to go in the direction of reducing the background field. Of course, going much beyond this has proven difficult. We were able to do some calculations along with people here like Dan Wojnarowski and Rich Holman of looking at back reaction effects in electromagnetism. The problems in gravity are more difficult, and so far I would say have resisted a complete solution by these methods. So we started thinking, I mean, we were intrigued by all of this and started thinking over the years about what this means and how it could eventually play itself out. If you take what is the standard the sort of canonical definition of the state in textbooks now and from the literature in the 80s, that's the maximally symmetric state. So most general relativists would say, well, I don't know how to define a vacuum, but a natural thing to do is to demand the full symmetries of the background space. So if the background space has this De Sitter group of 0-4-1 symmetry, let me require that of the state and see what happens. Well, that state, of course, has time reversal symmetry and in some sense is a thermal state. But as I also looked at back in the 80s, it in a sense has a negative heat capacity. If you just integrate up the energy over one horizon volume, that's inversely proportional to the Hawking-De Sitter temperature, h over 2 pi. I should have mentioned the Hawking-De Sitter temperature is h over 2 pi. So this is, of course, similar to what you see in the case of the Schwarzschild black hole, and its interpretation is a bit mysterious, right, as to whether or not that means the state is unstable or into what it actually devolves, and should I interpret this as an entropy or temperature at all. So I'm going very quickly over these things. I'm sure people have opinions. I've written many papers on the subject, so let's have some time to discuss it. But I felt I had to review some of this stuff just starting off, because this sort of background goes back now at least 25 years or more. So the other thing you can do is you can ask, well, if the Hawking De Sitter temperature is h over 2 pi, what happens if, am I really forced to take that to be the temperature of a thermal ensemble? And you are not, of course, if you construct a state which has a different Euclidean periodicity and a different thermal interpretation with an arbitrary temperature T, what you find is quite curious. You find that the stress tensor, normalized, regularized stress tensor of a typical quantum field, any field, behaves divergently on the De Sitter static horizon if the temperature is different than T Hawking. If it's equal to T Hawking, then this just divergence just canceled, and there is no such divergence. It's, of course, a regular state in the usual sense over 0-4-1. But you would ask yourself, if you're a thermal physicist or a statistical physicist, why am I forced to have a single temperature? So if I have temperature, I typically have thermal fluctuations, and the temperature can vary slightly away from the mean. And this tells me that something very peculiar happens near the horizon if the temperature varies only very slightly from the Hawking-De Sitter temperature. This is another indication that something very sensitive in the infrared is taking place in De Sitter space. There's, of course, no such effect in flat space. Sure.
Can you tell me with respect to which state is the Everson?
This is with respect to a thermal state built on the static time coordinates. So I take the static time and make them thermally populated. And if the thermal population is exactly with the Hawking-De Sitter temperature, this vanishes. But if it's not, it diverges.
What happens if you do that? Because not the coordinates.
Doesn't matter. You can, of course, it's harder to do it that way because these are most naturally set up in those coordinates. But of course, anything you do in one coordinate, you can transform to the other. So this is not temperature in the same.
If you try to construct a state in cosmological coordinates, which looks like a thermal state, so it's populated thermally about what would be a vacuum state in those coordinates, would you see a similar divergence?
Well,
I don't think so.
Well, no, because the temperature, that means something very different. If you define your positive and negative frequencies with respect to the Robertson-Walker time, it's of course totally different globally than defining those modes with respect to the static time. So therefore, it's not, and it's not a time, it's not a symmetry, right? Time translation in the Robertson Walker frame is not a time symmetry, so it's not a symmetry of the space, so it's not a natural thing to do. If you do put an initial state with a some thermal distribution, you know very well it will redshift away. Okay, but that is not the state I'm talking about. Well, it's a problem or a feature that needs to be understood.
Yeah. Robert, I think this would be a state in the interval section that you mean. It would be a state that would have excitations of arbitrarily short wavelength modes. You would have modes with arbitrarily short
wavelengths. Yeah, one can convert, of course. One can always take modes in one.
But it would not be a thermal state in those quantities.
No, but the point is that it would have these excitations that have arbitrarily short distances. Yeah. So that's why probably many studies you would just discard this level.
Absolutely. It's an in the cosmological coordinates, it would look like an ultraviolet.
But of course, when you have a divergence, you don't have to go all the way to the divergence. If the fact is that it's unbounded means that you can take perfectly regular states in which there are short distance excitations in the Robertson-Walker frame, and they would still correspond to very large stress tensors in the, not necessarily infinite anymore, but very large stress tensors, because that's unbounded. So you can get very close to a state and still be it'd still be formally regular, but an ultraviolet finite, but still have very large effects. So of course one can make these conversions, they're just changes of coordinates. More questions? Okay. So I'm sure we'll hear more about this as well. When you try to construct thermal states or 041 invariant states for massless minimally coupled fields or gravitons. There are again infrared issues, logarithmic growth, for example, of propagators. So as a number of people have mentioned, there is no cluster decomposition in the way you need it in quantum field theory to make wave packets and discuss scattering, and an S matrix doesn't seem to exist in De Sitter space. There have been attempts to look at that. Other folks, I think, have also looked at spontaneous symmetry breaking in De Sitter space and noticed that it's actually very similar to massless theories in D equals two dimensions. You know that you cannot spontaneously break a global symmetry in two dimensions because basically a massless field would be created, a Goldstone field, which in two dimensions has a logarithmically growing propagator. So that means the state is infrared poorly behaved, and we believe that the symmetry would be restored by the quantum fluctuations. That's basically what's behind costless Dallas phase transitions in two dimensions. So the Merman-Wagner theorem is in two dimensions is due to that effect. And in four dimensions, again, because of logarithmic growth, it looks again like there are long distance effects that you can't just ignore in the infrared and De Sitter space. So pondering over all these things over the years, I mean, there are, of course, lots of things you can go back here and do differently. I welcome you to go and look at these states, for example, in the Robertson-Walker case. We looked at that. You can look at more closely at these infrared divergences, try to set up perturbation theory. That's what, for example, Polyakov is talking about in the last few papers. But I would say all of this sort of accumulating evidence of non-trivial infrared effects in De Sitter space indicates there's something missing in the way we're understanding this. And this is not just a trivial or perturbative effect on top of a stable background.
Globally, there should be.
Well, I mean, that's how it is in two dimensions too. You can have local order, but eventually disorder at very large distances. Same thing. Okay. So with all of that introduction, I now want to turn to my main topic, which is thinking about how one should think about effective field theory and the role of anomalies, and then we'll apply that to De Sitter space and I think it will have some interesting and non-trivial effects in the infrared. So again, very quickly, what is an effective field theory? It's a lore more than more an art than a science, I would say, that's developed in a number of fields over the years. But basically, to distill it to its basics, it's that you should try to identify the symmetries of your system and expand, identify fields, continuous variables that transform simply or homogeneously under those symmetries, and then construct invariants and construct an action principle that's built over those invariants in an ascending power series in the derivatives of local invariants. So basically, if you think about that, that again boils down to an assumption, a very physically reasonable assumption, that ultraviolet physics can be decoupled from long-distance physics so that I can describe, for example, sound waves in this room by an effective field theory without really knowing everything about the microscopic physics.
Want to assume that the effective action is local?
No. Okay. So it's exactly the point I'm going to criticize.
Okay.
So thank you for saying that. You see, this is what happens when you talk to experts. So. Can't say anything, right? Absolutely correct. So basically, I think this is the lore about effective field theory. It usually works, and it works because of this decoupling. But precisely my point is going to be that when you have massless fields, you can see very clearly, even in perturbative amplitudes in flat space, that they do not decouple. And no surprise, right? A massless field has an infinite Compton wavelength, so why should it decouple at very large distances? Its fluctuations are always relevant, so to speak. And in particular, we have some experience with this in theories that have experimental basis. You know, in quantum gravity, it's notoriously difficult to test anything by experiment. So in addition to trying to reason in a clear and logical way with correct mathematics, we also have to look at other systems that have something to teach us from the real world, because otherwise we may be missing the boat completely in trying to generalize these ideas to gravity. So the chiral and conformal symmetries in ordinary field theories are anomalous, and these do lead to macroscopic effects. And indeed, this is just my point, Richard, that special non-local terms must be added to the low-energy effective field theory to take account of that. So in a sense that I'm trying to make very explicit in the next few slides, there is a kind of infrared sensitivity, a residual infrared sensitivity to the ultraviolet degrees of freedom, which basically prevents you from having a completely local expansion. You already have. Go ahead. So what's your Wilson versus, say, the exact quantum action?
Yes, right.
Yes,
so
okay.
That's right.
That's right. Okay, that's a matter of language which we should get clear. So what I'm going to say, I think, is coming from the quantum exact action, but nevertheless has implications for low-energy physics, which you cannot see except by adding non-local terms to the Wilson effective action.
Well, so the claim would be that short-distance physics is giving you non-local effects in the Wilson action, and then you're adding to that the integration over the long distance that are massless modes.
Right.
And so
there's another term or set of terms in the low energy effective Wilson action, if you wish. I mean, it's an extension of the Wilson idea. I mean, it's maybe an abuse of Wilson to call it the Wilson action. But, I mean, what we're trying to get at is whether or not there are physical effects at large distances that arise from quantum loops. Okay, and...
not the massless quantum loops, the massive quantum loops.
Well, it's the massless one, so it's not Wilson in that sense. Okay, so yes, let's... I need another word for it. You'll tell me what word I should use. But we ought to make this precise. Okay. Yes?
No, I'm not sure, but just to make sure that we do have a clear understanding.
It gets clearer, I think, in the, if you look at
I have the impression, because from what you were saying, it seemed as if you were asking whether there was a sort of double counting, that you were getting these infrared effects from the non-local terms that you get by integrating the light modes, the massless fields, and so on, and whether on top of that there's something else. And if I understand correctly, I think that what Emil is trying to do is that the effects that we are interested in are these effects that you have just coming from the massless fields, for the light fields that will give you something non-local. But I think, maybe Emil can correct or explain that. I think that, because I've discussed a lot with him.
He's another expert.
So I think that what he's trying to do is that he's trying to extract the information on these non-local effects from the massless fields by somehow looking at certain UV features, anomalies, and so on. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to extract some part of the information on these non-local effects that you get from the massless fields by somehow getting that information from the UV. Isn't that more or less? But it's not that you're counting two
The word double counting didn't come up. I don't know. That's what
but I got the impression that he maybe had that in mind.
Let's go through a couple of examples, okay? So I won't get to the end of my talk, that's fine. We can do that over coffee or something. But I think it's important to understand the general framework. So let's take an example that at least all the particle physicists in the house will recognize and immediately embrace, which is the axial chiral anomaly in QCD. So we know that if we write down a theory of massless quarks, NF flavor of them, we naturally have in the non-abelian gauge theory a full UNF cross UNF chiral symmetry. In other words, we can rotate those fermions into each other with unitary n-dimensional matrices, or we can put a gamma 5 in those matrices and mix up the axial symmetry with it. Now, as we also know from the 70s, basically, is that the U1 part of the chiral symmetry is anomalous. And what does that mean? Well, phenomenologically, of course, it means something very important. It means that rather than having all NF squared generators of the chiral symmetry group representing directions in which there are Goldstone-like particles, you have one less than that. So if you have two flavors, if NF equals 2, you have up and down quarks, then instead of having 4 light pseudoscalar Goldstone bosons, you have only 3. And those are identified with the pi plus, pi minus, and neutral pion. Okay, so this has a low energy effect, right? Now, what is the understanding of this? Well, basically, that if you couple quarks to either non-abelian gauge fields or abelian electromagnetic fields, then there's a famous triangle diagram where these quarks run around the loop, and there's a gamma 5 chiral current vertex here. Is that this current, which should be one of the nether currents of that U chiral symmetry, in other words, the U1 part of it, which is flavor independent, that part cannot be conserved due to this loop diagram. And you know, there are long discussions of this. And basically, no matter how you regularize this diagram, you cannot satisfy the Ward identities at the vector vertices and satisfy the Ward identity you would need to maintain this nether current being conserved at the quantum level. And if you demand the Ward identities are conserved, are satisfied at the vector vertices, you necessarily get a well-defined and finite term for the right-hand side of the divergence of the axial current, the famous FF dual. Now, this is important in several different ways. So, and we should, since the question already arose, we should take a minute to think about this, because certainly it's phenomenologically important. In the low energy effective theory of QCD, we do know that the neutral pion decayed to two photons is actually mediated through this process. This was a puzzle in the late 60s, early 70s, why, if the pion was so light, it decayed with the rate it did to two photons. It violates the naive soft pion theorems, which would be derived from the Ward identities of the U1 chiral symmetry. But of course, if those symmetries are broken by the anomaly, then there will be an extra term. And when you put in this extra term with the correct numbers and fractionally charged assignments of the quarks, you get exactly the right answer for the pion decay. And this, of course, played historically a very important role in establishing QCD. And when people first started to think maybe fractionally charged confined quarks were not so crazy after all, if it could produce the right answer for the neutral pion decay. So you cannot write this down in the chiral limit as a local action. There are various constructions. Witten, of course, wrote down a five-dimensional action and derived it as a boundary term. But if you're strictly in the chiral limit of massless quarks, there is no local operator in the low energy theory now defined by the pion fields in which you can describe this decay. You have to add an explicit term. So Steve Weinberg isn't here, but if you look in his book, you'll see that that's exactly what he does. He says that we know from the underlying microscopic or ultraviolet physics, if you wish, of QCD, that there is this anomalous process or anomalous graph. So we have to correct our low energy theory by making it transform in the right way to have the breaking of the U1 chiral symmetry dictated by this term. In other words, it has to be consistent with the Ward identities of the anomalous theory. So if you now cogitate on this a bit, you see that what's really happened is that some part of the ultraviolet theory, namely in this case QCD, in the perturbative sector of massless quarks, has influenced a low-energy infrared matrix element. So this is an example of how you get infrared effects from the ultraviolet anomaly. Okay, if you didn't put this term in, you would completely miss it, and you would completely miss the pion decay rate, for example. So I don't know if that helps Cliff to sharpen this point, but maybe we should discuss it.
What you're saying is that this is an example of a non-local thing that you obtain by integrating out short distance physics in the chiral Lagrangian. It's just there and it came from. So it would be the counterexample to the statement that short distance physics can't give you non-local things.
Well, I get it's not. I mean, what short distance or long distance is, of course, has to be taken very carefully here. You can look at the amplitude. You're really integrating over modes over all wavelengths. It's not coming from the deep ultraviolet.
But the current Lagrangian argument could have said it's just I'm integrating out the QCD scale, and so now I'm at low energy for that.
Yeah.
And I've got a chiral Lagrangian involving. And the Wessamino term is capturing the short distance physics that the quarks are no longer there to carry the anomaly, so that once you integrate them out, you get the Wessamino term. But I think that the statement would be, the way I would have said that is that it's a local action expressed in terms of the pion fields. It is local. It's true that if you want to write that in a global way, in a topologically meaningful way, you write it as a boundary or something, but you could write that out as powers of the pion field in an ugly way if you wanted to.
And then, we're one over pi's, I mean.
Yeah.
No, but that.
So in the Abelian case,
but in the strictly massless limit with no chiral symmetry breaking, there is no local term.
Well, if it had been a U1 and not a non-Abelian one, it would have just been pi zero FF dual, and that would have been the local thing.
But that needs a 1 over F pi. So,
yeah.
So you're already presuming the SUNF is chiral symmetry breaking. So if you just took the U1 part and there is no chiral, you know, no otherwise chiral symmetry breaking, you can't obtain this in a local way, right?
That's the thing I'm resisting, but we could probably talk
about it. Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. But you're right, of course, in the actual QCD case. You can write it as a dimension 5 operator divided by the pions. Notice it's not divided by some QCD scale, which would be what you would expect from effective theory. You would expect that when you integrate out modes, you get 1 over the ultraviolet scale there, which would be lambda QCD. Here it's not, except pi.
Those are almost the same thing, right?
No. But that's a coincidence of nature. But in principle, those are completely different physics, right? We could imagine a world which we have very, very light quarks, you know, orders of magnitude lighter than the real world, close to the chiral limit, and f pi were something very different from lambda QCD. And then this would be, you know, of course here you're right, the infrared and ultraviolet scale separate by less than an order of magnitude. It's the pi on 150, 140 MeV from lambda QCD. But in principle, it's quite different. There's a different physics.
Can I just be clear about the claim? So suppose I imagine integrating out quark fields of all momenta, free momenta, bigger than a certain amount, on TEV, say, is the claim that you would induce such a non-local term from the ultraviolet sector that you're integrating out?
I don't integrate
out all the quark fields, I just integrate out.
No, you would get only a very small fraction of this coefficient. Most of the spectral density is coming from much lower than that.
The infrared part. So it really is light particles which are doing most
I mean, you know, there's no mystery. You can go pull this amplitude apart and look at it. I mean, I was going to talk about 2D gravity, but now I'm wondering if I should talk. Maybe I'll jump to this, because this is the closest case since people have asked these questions, and it's a calculation we did about a year and a half ago. So it again addresses these issues about infrared versus ultraviolet. So here's a case with a gravitational coupling, a stress tensor, that's as close as possible to the axial case. That's why I jumped to this. And I just replaced here the chiral current by the stress tensor. And let's take QED, let's keep it simple, no non-abelian fields. These are just photon lights. And consider this triangle diagram. Well, long ago in the 80s, Hatherell and others calculated that in the massless limit, if I take the quarks, now electrons, just massless in this theory, in this loop, then nevertheless, the trace of the energy momentum tensor is non-zero. Okay, and it's known what the trace is. By heat kernel techniques, they calculated that it's proportional to F squared, the external electromagnetic field. So this is very similar, of course, to the FF dual, the only difference being replacing pseudoscalars by scalars. So it's a nice case to study if you really want to understand all these issues, and that's why we went back and did it, because we were doing all these calculations using the effective action from integrating the anomaly, the Polyakov form, and the four-dimensional version of that, which is, you know, really the subject of my talk, and I won't get to. But this is a nice example which one can go through and really see in flat space without any fancy functional stuff what's really going on. So basically, just redo this thing. And it's curious, nobody ever bothered to look at the full amplitude. Of course, that's a bit more complicated. It has more indices, A, B, C, and D. But it's clear that if I vary the stress tensor expectation value in a background electric magnetic field twice with respect to the gauge potential, then I must pick up the effect of this quadratic invariant. So that's why the triangle diagram is the relevant diagram to look at. And here it's summarized, but I might as well go through it a little bit more in detail, since this is kind of the questions you're asking. When you look at this full amplitude, the trace, if I trace over here A and B, it just gives me K. K is the momentum injected at this vertex, which by momentum conservation is P plus Q of the two photon lights. This will give me 3K squared, of course, but this has to be non-zero, the whole amplitude, because of this. This tensor is nothing else but the Fourier transform of the FF dual in Fourier space. And you see, so if 3K squared times all of this is going to be non-zero, that means this object must develop a pole at k squared equal to zero. And indeed, you can just do this calculation and find that it does. So, and there, the corresponding spectral function, which is the question you're asking, Richard, about where the meat is, so to speak, coming from, is actually coming from a massless intermediate state in the center of mass energy, S, injected from the left side. So I'll go through this. I wasn't going to go through this, but maybe just quickly, just to give you the flavor of what you, of how this works. So my five-minute warning. Okay, so this will be the last thing I do. I don't get to any of my talk, but that's fine. So I already inflicted this on you without a blackboard, right? So maybe we can do the rest over coffee and stuff. So, but let me finish up and make this point clear, because it really is an important point, which I think has been there all along. For example, Professor Dolgoff, who's here, where are you, made a point like this back in the 70s. And I think for various reasons, I'll just speak for myself, I didn't appreciate this for many years until quite recently going through this carefully again. So there really is a massless excitation hiding in this graph. And to really illustrate that this is not an ultraviolet, but really an infrared issue. So the normal way you would do this, right, is you'd say, okay, here's a diagram. I pull out my favorite book on dimensional regularization, and I write this all down in n dimensions because there are three fermion propagators, so the three powers of momenta downstairs. I'm integrating over four momenta upstairs, and I have the stress tensor vertex, which for fermions has one power of momentum. So I have five powers upstairs and three downstairs. It's a naively quadratically divergent graph. It's ultraviolet divergent. Oops, I better do something. Let me do dimensional regularization. And of course, you can do it that way, or polyvelars. However, you can do it a quite different way, which Dolgoff actually emphasized way back in the 70s. And that is, you can essentially just apply the Ward identities at the level of the full amplitude before you take any divergence. And you basically say, OK, by Lorentz invariance, I have to be able to expand this amplitude, which has four indices in all the possible tensors, which I can build out of the available objects, P, Q, and the metric tensor in flat space. Okay, then I start demanding the Ward identities. So here's, of course, where you put physical input. Rather than calculating by dimensional regularization, you demand that these tensors satisfy current conservation at this vertex and at this one. And that's very important, because what it does is it pulls out P's and Q's into these tensors, and you generally pull out four factors here of momenta. So something that was quadratically divergent is now has four external momentum factors, which means the remaining scalar amplitudes are quadratically convergent. So that's the essence of this. And if you write things down in all the possible tensors, and you take the dispersive part, which is always finite, and you construct the full amplitude by the finite real parts and demanding Lorentz invariance by expanding in these tensors. And there's a Ward identity, of course, for current conservation at the stress tensor. That's what it is in terms of the ordinary vacuum polarization of QED. And when you're done, you get a whole set of terms. And that's, of course, why most people wouldn't have bothered to do it, because it's a little bit tedious. Now with Mathematica and a good postdoc, it's not a problem. And such Maurizio was. And so we're able to do this. We checked it several ways. There are 13 different terms, but most of them are uninteresting. They're basically non-anomalous. The important term is this one, which is the one I had on the first slide. And you see now I've taken this dimension 2 object. I've written in terms of four explicit powers of momenta outside. That's in order to satisfy the Ward identity. And then the remaining function is completely finite. And so you can write it down here and see where the contribution is coming from. This is just a Feynman parameterization of that resulting scalar integral. And you see that most of the stuff is coming from momentum scales, which are comparable to either the mass or the external virtual momenta of the photons, p squared and q squared. If you put p squared, q squared, and m squared equal to 0, then actually the whole amplitude develops the scalar pole, which is just sitting out in front. So you can, of course, do the whole thing for a finite mass. If you have a finite mass, this is the term. But if you put the mass to zero, then you just get the simple pole behavior, which I showed. So all of this way of doing it, although it's a little bit work, actually shows that the main effect is not coming from the strong ultraviolet modes. It's coming, it has nothing to do with regularization. It has to do only with the ward identities. If the regularization scheme you use preserves the ward identities, then you're guaranteed to get this answer no matter how you do it, what the regularization is. And this shows that it's actually independent of that. So the pole is there, and you can understand it in the spectral function language. So if you write that amplitude in terms of spectral functions, there's a non-anomalous part which goes to zero with the mass. That would be just what you would expect from the naive ward identity. And then there's this interesting other part which has, in the spectral form, you have a k-squared plus s in the denominator, but a k-squared plus s in the numerator, which says that, of course, the imaginary part is non-anomalous. The imaginary part is a delta. Multiplying this is zero. But the real part is anomalous, and that's the anomaly. And so here's the exact form of the spectral function in this one-loop amplitude. It's interesting to see that this spectral function for any p squared, q squared, or m squared, independently of those parameters, satisfies a ultraviolet finite sum rule. So if you integrate the spectral form over center of mass energy S, you get a well-defined finite answer. So that means, again, the contributions are not coming from the extreme ultraviolet. It's a convergent integral, and it's only dependent on the scales you put in. If you put no scales in, then it has to come only from zero. And indeed, that's what happens in the limit you just exactly see. If I put all the dimensionful quantities to zero, this just becomes a delta S, and this is just a finite integral. And so the spectral function is a finite integral, a finite coefficient times a spectral density at exactly S equal to zero, which corresponds to this massless scalar pole. So this is the illustration of the main effect that I want to say that, you know, we should understand by staring at this example before we perhaps go on to talk about the effects in gravity. So my time's up. And okay, so I was going to talk about how this can be understood as a two-particle state. Basically, you pull this amplitude apart. There's no mystery, right? It's a one-loop amplitude. And so basically what's happening is as you go to zero momentum, zero mass for the particles, you have an E plus and E minus, which are traveling collinearly, massless at the speed of light, and with opposite helicities, so behaving just like a zero plus scalar state. This is the state that's in this two-particle density matrix with a delta function of S. And it couples with a finite amplitude to both the stress tensor on this side, and therefore to gravity, and to two photons on the other side. So you can write down an effective theory of this in which you have a massless scalar exchange between the traceful part of T mu nu and F squared describing two photons on the right-hand side. There is an effective action. This is one example of the general effective action of the anomaly. Here it's done in flat space in a background electromagnetic field, but one can do the same thing in a background gravitational field, in which case these photons are replaced by gravitons. And so we checked, for example, that if I take the ordinary tree-level amplitude of scattering in gravity, so here there are two photons exchanging a gravitational field, a graviton, if you wish, with some massive source, say, then normally, of course, in Einstein's theory, the only things that propagate in that intermediate state are the spin 2 transverse traceless excitations, gravitational waves. The scalar parts are there, but they are non-propagating, much like the Coulomb field in electromagnetism, just gives you a static interaction with no propagating Coulomb, no propagating or retarded Coulomb field. But If you now redo this diagram but put our triangle that we just calculated on the right-hand side, then because of this scalar mode, you can just see this, there's nothing to cancel it. It basically survives in the full amplitude and therefore can be described now as a scalar exchange between this energy momentum tensor trace and F squared on the other side. So this is a real effect, by the way, which you know, in real QED is going to be screened due to the mass of the electron, right? So this won't apply for strictly massless, for strictly light fields. But if you looked at, for example, gamma rays scattering off the sun, perhaps this would actually have some interesting effects, which are predicted by quantum field theory. But from our purposes, the main point is that this amplitude already illustrates that there can be scalar massless states coming from the anomaly in the two particle intermediate states of certain anomalous amplitudes, which couple to the trace of the energy momentum tensor. And if, for example, if you now took the triangle of three stress tensors and took truly massless particles, massless photons, then coupling to the gravitational excitations, gravitons now, then this also has a similar pole. So the moral to me is that anomalous amplitudes do have long-distance effects, and if you truly have massless degrees of freedom, there can be some kind of composite-like states. They're not bound states, but they're correlated, two-particle correlated states in the density matrix, which, for those of you who know condensed matter physics, there's nothing surprising about that at all. It happens all the time in media, for example. Although the Coulomb field is non-propagating in vacuum, when we put charges in a plasma, free charges moving, then the very fact that the electric field is constrained by Gauss's law means that because the charge density fluctuates, the electric field has to fluctuate even in the longitudinal sector, and that's called the plasmon. So there is a collective interaction, a collective excitation in the plasma, which is not there in the vacuum. What is surprising to most field theorists is that even in the vacuum, the ordinary, plain, Lorentz invariant, Minkowski vacuum, you can find this two-particle correlated state, which is a hint of a collective excitation, but only if you look in this very special sector of anomalous amplitudes. So this, of course, is the main fundamental point, which has to be understood before we go on and apply it to gravity, but that's what I wanted to do in, you know, the last hour of my 3-hour talk. So I'll stop. Thank you.
Dolly Singer trace theorem.
So theology, yeah.
And in fact, those modes that you're talking about are these zero modes that are crossing.
Yeah.
Now, how can one understand in that language the crossing of these zero modes, the Fermi surface, or the acute to the Fermi surface?
You mean for the trace anomaly?
Yeah.
It hasn't been done. I'm sure it has a similar interpretation, but just nobody is geared up to do that Hamiltonian calculus. It's a good exercise.
The ultraviolet infrared is because the modes that are crossing here are being depleted at the bottom of the
surface,
of the Dirac
surface. Right, so it has an ultraviolet, you know, face to it, because if there weren't an infinite sea, there would be no way to hide this effect. But most of the stuff is happening right at the Fermi surface, in this case, the Dirac surface, if you like, of the vacuum. It's right at the edge of the allowed kinematic region. Delta of S is right at, you know, at S equals zero.
I think that suggests that there has to be some index theorem or something that...
Yeah. Could be. Yeah, I mean, it's known for the chiral case. It's not known for the trace case.
Come
on.
Yeah, so I guess you're not saying that this scale non-propagating is what you're talking about. You might just talking about something in regards to gravity, some complex.
Why would you think what I'm talking about is not what you're talking about? Sorry.
No. I mean, can you tell us? Can you tell me again? Please? I don't understand. What is this scale? How can I think of
this
scale?
It's a correlated state. The word composite is a little misleading because usually it means a bound state, right? But it's a correlated state in the two-body phase space. Okay, so it's basically in the Hilbert space, a dagger, or b dagger for a particle and an antiparticle. Okay, and that two-particle state in the underlying quantum theory behaves like a scalar mode as far as intermediate propagating states in these amplitudes.
Well, you're talking about a multi-particle. This is QED, no gravity.
This is QED coupled only to, using the stress tensor, but in that sense it's tickling the gravitational field, but I'm evaluating everything in flat space.
Are you saying that so there's a two-particle electron state that's contributing to this correlation function, or are you saying that that two-particle state is behaving like a single-particle pole or some level?
I said both. Like the same. What's the difference?
Well, in the sense of that it's the difference between a composite state and just two particles that have to be moving together in the same direction. Are you saying there's some dynamics that's making this thing behave as a bound state?
No, it's not bound, because of course we calculated a perturbative amplitude, right? Yeah. That's why you should go through this in some detail. Because you see, nothing's been put in. There's no ladder exchange, there's nothing to bind these particles together. They're not interacting except for the external waves.
I completely accept the point. I accept the point that the anomalies are infrared things.
Yes.
So then, probably because you didn't get to the end of your talk, I'm not sure what the punchline was. Well,
here is a punchline, half punchline, right? This is an important point to stop, because I'm saying even if we didn't do anything fancier, then QED coupled to external fields, we would already see from this anomalous diagram, which is as close as possible to the axial anomaly, that there are massless infrared states in the low energy sector of gravity, which are coming from these two particle correlations in the underlying field theory. So there's no double counting, because you're entitled to look at it either way. They're equivalent. You can think of you can go back to the original field theory and say, well, these are electron two particle states. But as far as the gravitational interactions are concerned, if I don't look at electrons in the final states, but only in loops, then for the effective action concerning only, in this case, gravitational and electromagnetic external fields, it looks like I have a scalar state. We'll be able to tell the difference.
Is there a long-range effect?
Yeah.
So violation of the equivalence principle due to massless fermions.
It's not a violation of the equivalence principle. If by equivalence principle one means general covariance, because of course everything here is invariant. But you're asking whether or not there are long-range gravitational forces. Well. You mean, if it were strictly massless electrons, then one has to go through this and ask, what are the effects in this? There could be, in principle, some effects, associated, for example, nothing tells you a priori that the scattering of light off a gravitational source cannot have, for example, polarization-dependent effects. So one has to then go to some... You're thinking of the classical limit of gravity where everything is geodesics, and of course this is a scattering diagram, which is not the same thing. So you'd have to go to a WKB-like limit and ask whether or not there are any residual effects.
I'm thinking that there's a hidden sector which may contain massless fermions, just massless fermions. And indirectly, this effect, according to you, will give rise to a correction to the long-range interaction between metal.
In principle.
And that would limit, which is otherwise very hard, the presence of massless fermions somewhere.
In principle, yes. But of course the full consequences of this has to be extracted from this. It hasn't been done. That caveat. I'd be happy to discuss. Someone else? You're the chairman.
this is about your earlier comment before you got into this. I know you don't agree with me, but there is a different variant much higher state for three.
Well, let's discuss that. That's one reason.
It's
to
not us, but I don't know.
Okay. Okay, let's discuss that.
So why don't we two more quick ones and we'll go for graphics, right?
Okay. So I don't have any objections to that. I'm sometimes cast as your nemesis in this. I don't have any objections to this.
I never thought of it that way. Who's casting them?
It seems to me like you've made a very convincing case that such a thing exists and that there is such a degree of freedom. I'm just troubled by conformal invariance. That in order to get the effect, you need the fermions to be massless, and it's in exactly that limit that they tend to decouple to the expansion of the universe. So although I think there is certainly going to be such an effect, it seems to me it's going to be suppressed as far as coupling to the expansion of the universe and hence having cosmological implications. And I guess that's my intuition. I guess I'd just like you to comment on that.
Well, that's where I was going with this, and that is going to loop back to this question about thermal states in De Sere space, because it's these modes which lead to those effects on the horizon in either Schwarzschild case or in the De Sere case. So in that sense, they're not small at all. They can even be extremely large and dominated with the classical.
Wouldn't you expect bigger
effects? But I'm not going to convince you of that in one sentence. So.
Right. I agree that they're going to be bigger than classical. I just would expect even bigger from things from quantum effects that themselves classically violated conformal invariance and hence didn't have to have this suppressing symmetry.
Well,
like, for example, a massless minimally coupled scalar or gravitons themselves.
Well, gravitons themselves will contribute to these things, but. And I want to emphasize here, while we're on this point, that the effect is there even if you put in the mass. Of course, if you look at scales which are much larger than the Compton wavelength, then they're going to be suppressed. That's what decoupling is. Okay. So this example with electrons is mostly to be pedagogical, because it's close to the axial case, which we all know and love, and you can just see the whole thing in ordinary old-fashioned QED. But, of course, the real implications come from truly massless particles, of which there are, like the photon and the graviton. And that's why this remark, that then what you have to calculate to see this effect is three T's in flat space. So that's a bit harder calculation.
Yeah.
Okay, but we already know the answer, I would claim, because we already know that the stress tensor divergence, the stress tensor trace, for massless fields has an anomaly, and from the same logic, because there's an anomaly in the expectation value of T, when I vary twice and calculate the full amplitude, I will have a massless pole there. Okay, so the massless excitations and gravitational scattering amplitudes exist for massless fields, and they're not suppressed by anything.
Mm-hmm. Right, good.
Good. Okay, but to get to their cosmological effects, I think will take us a little longer.
Sorry, I have a very naive question. I just didn't understand. These low energy cerions, how do they help in understanding of the screening of lambda?
Low energy theorems. Which low energy theorems?
I call these by low energy cerions, but I mean the fact that you have anomaly and interpretation in terms of this massless particles, how does it?
Well, my point is that there are new degrees of freedom that have to be taken into account, and that those degrees of freedom have long-range effects which can influence the effective value of the cosmological term. I mean, this is in some of the review articles, and as I said, it would take another chunk of time to go through, but I'm happy to discuss it. But that's, in a nutshell, that's the point. I mean, where does it come from? I mean, it first seems kind of magical. You know, how is it that all of a sudden something which was a constant is running? Well, you have to identify the right fluctuations which influence that quantity at large distances. Well, my claim is that these modes, which you can see even in flat space by these poles, are those degrees of freedom. Okay?
Right, maybe that's, I think we can talk
about
this all day,
probably. No time for coffee.
So
okay.
Come back in about 10 minutes.
Okay.